that same old place, sweet home Chicago. One and one is two, two and two is four. Love me, baby, now, and love me slow. Come on, baby, don't you want to go back to that same old place, the sweet home Chicago.
Time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who've got their tongues running 100 miles per hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today, I've got a hot goober for you, a corporate chieftain who's hot under the collar about a piece of legislation that would allow workers in a company to form a union if a majority of them sign written cards declaring they want to unionize. This simple step toward a bit of workplace democracy is necessary because the corporate powers have rigged our labor laws so company executives can intimidate, shut out, and even fire employees who attempt to join with co-workers in a union. Some 60% of working people say they'd join a union tomorrow if they could, and their proposed Employee Free Choice Act would make that possible. That's what fired up today's Gooberhead awardee, Bernie Marcus, the co-founder of Home Depot. He profits from low-wage, non-union workers, and he doesn't want any democratic changes that would dilute his autocratic control over working folks. So, in a conference call with several other corporate executives, Marcus blew a gasket. "This is the demise of a civilization," he screeched, adding, "This is how a civilization disappears." Wow, Bernie, get a grip. Allowing Home Depot workers to organize democratically and gain a say over their livelihoods is actually quite civilized. An advance, not a demise. Of course, Marcus was talking about his own little exclusive civilization, those corporate fiefdoms controlled by self-serving petty autocrats like him. Indeed, he is so threatened by this reform legislation that he lashed out at CEOs of other retail chains, declaring that if they're not putting up money to defeat the Free Choice Act, quote, they should be shot. This is Jim Hightower saying, I think he meant it.
KOP, Hornsby, Austin. KOP.org on the World Wide Web. Thanks to Jim Hightower for the incessant commentary, and to Isidoro and Johnny for the lively music. People United starts now. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. My guests this week are filmmaker Matthew Gossage, who, with another filmmaker, made the film Dante Hutto, America's Family Prison. We're also here with activists Bob Leibel and Luisana Santibanez, who are from the Grassroots Leadership. We're going to be discussing immigrant family detention, including the Grassroots Leadership's 100 Actions in 100 Days campaign to end immigrant family detention. That opening music is different from our usual theme song. That opening music actually comes from the opening music of the film Matt did. Matt, remind me, who is the person you made the film with?
Her name is Lily Kieber. She's a filmmaker based out of New Orleans.
Okay. I want to now the music we just heard was music that also opens the film that you did with Lily.
Yeah, that's correct.
Who's it by?
Fuga.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the making of the film, how you kind of came across this subject of the Hutto facility.
Yeah, sure. Probably all started about 2.5 years ago, the end of 2006. I saw a press release written by Louis Sana, kind of called for the first vigil of the Tidon Hutto residential facility. And prior to that, that was the first I had heard of the prison. That year I had been to some of the immigrant rights marches in 2006 and was aware of kind of the backlash against immigration that kind of the right wing in this country had been enacting. But when I read that press release, it told about a vigil outside a private prison that was a converted adult prison and housed non-criminal immigrants and their families, including young children. And it was a private prison that was profiting off of this, and I was just appalled by it. So I went out and I videotaped that, and I documented some of the first early vigils and protests outside the prison.
You videotaped what exactly?
It was a vigil outside of the prison. This was December 2006, and it was a vigil in solidarity with the families that were in prison inside there and just kind of trying to raise awareness and attention about the prison and about our government's new policy of imprisoning immigrants and their families.
So I noticed you have quite a few interviews. Tell us a little bit about some of the people you met along the way.
I was able to connect with a couple people that were inside the prison. A woman, her name is Denia, was gracious enough to share her story with us. She was in the Hutto prison with her two children. At the time, she was pregnant. She was, I believe, in Hutto for eight months. And she was seeking asylum from Honduras. And she was in Hutto with her 5-year-old and her 3-year-old daughter, and she was pregnant at the time. And she was losing weight and received very poor and very little medical care for her for being pregnant. I met with another woman who was also in Hutto with her son. I met another person, Selhadin, who was imprisoned in a separate immigration detention facility. And I spoke with lawyers that were involved in the case. This was in 2007. At the time, the ACLU and the University of Texas Law Clinic were involved in a lawsuit against Homeland Security to close down Hutto. And I also met with immigrant rights advocates in Austin that were looking for alternatives to this system of detention.
Now, Denia plays a very prominent role in your film, and one of the things that you and Lily point out is that she was denied extra food during the time that she was actually pregnant with one of her children.
Yes, that's correct. She received no extra food while she was pregnant, and there was very little medical attention at all for her.
Tell us a little bit about the story about the blankets.
Yeah, she. It was very cold. This is a converted medium security prison, and you know, she was in her cell with her two daughters, and it got very cold in there. So she, you know, they were only allowed one blanket per person there, and it got very cold. So she tried to get more blankets because the prison officials would not allow her to have more blankets. So she had to hide blankets inside pillowcases, and she was very nervous because guards constantly were threatening to separate parents with their children if they misbehaved or they spoke out too much. And I think my associate, Luisana, would also like to kind of jump in to fill in part of that story also.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think that her testimony speaks to the experiences that women in all prisons face and the methods that the methods of survival that they have to try and, you know, sneak through or do in order to survive the conditions of these prisons. And I think the fact that she had to sneak away an extra blanket and tuck it, you know, fear for her fear for her life, really, because she didn't know, and she was fearful that if caught, she would be separated from her children. And so I think that's one of the most powerful testimonies there.
That's the voice of Luisana Santibanez, who's with the Grassroots Leadership. We're also talking with Matthew Gossage, who's the co-creator of the film Hutto, America's Family Prison. Bob Leibel from Grassroots Leadership also joins us in the studio. I should point out, by the way, that Luisana and Matt are going to be speaking this coming Monday, February 9th at 6 p.m. at TICE headquarters, 1009 East 11th Street here in Austin. And they're going to be panelists in addition to Denia from the documentary. Also, Barbara Hines, who is in the documentary as well, you interviewed her, Matt. She's with the University of Texas Law Clinic. She's going to be in the panel as well, in addition to Professor Nessa Rodriguez. And Eric Tang, a professor of anthropology at UT, is going to be moderating.
And, yeah, I'd just like to say I'm glad you brought up that story, which is a prominent part of the video, is that it just kind of exemplifies how immigrants are criminalized and how the system of incarceration is normalized by the Department of Homeland Security. By these families that are just trying to stay warm, and how far our policy has gone to where, you know, this is seen as an appropriate policy to put families in prison.
Talk a little bit about privatization of prisons.
I'd like to refer to pass over to Bob. I mean, I just want to introduce it that Hutto is a privatized prison. It's owned by CCA, which is a Nashville, Tennessee-based company, Corrections Corporation of America. And the company has a contract with Homeland Security to run Hutto.
Okay, we can talk a little bit further about that, but... being focused just for a little moment on the documentary, you helped it together, Matt. One of the people I interviewed, I noticed, was a resident of Taylor, Texas, which is where Hutto is located. And for folks who don't know, Hutto is not very far away from Austin. It's in Williamson County in Taylor, Texas.
Yeah.
And so the resident who is also featured prominently in the film is Jose Orta. And... at one point in the documentary, you see him outside a closed rest home, and he's talking about a different place that Hutto could have been, not Hutto per se, but an immigrant family detention center could have been if it was really about residents. One of the things that you point out in the documentary is the fact that it used to be a run-of-the-mill corrections facility, which was actually retrofitted.
Yeah, that's correct. It used to be a prison that was operated in the 90s. It was a state-owned prison, and then through kind of decreasing prison populations in the 90s, it was sold, I believe, to Corrections Corporation of America, and they operated it for a couple years but had trouble keeping capacity, and then it was mothballed, so it was actually an empty prison for many years. And then following kind of the rise in immigration detention, it was reopened and refurbished to be the a family detention center.
And CCA got another federal contract, in this case with the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, we're going to go and get some of the commentary from Taylor resident Jose Orta. I'm Alan Campbell, and you're listening to People United on KOP Hornsby, Austin.
When I drive by this what used to be a rest home, I get depressed because I think about all of those kids that are at Tidan Hutto. They try to pawn that off. They try to sell it to the community as a residential facility, but it's still a medium security prison. Very little windows, very little, you know, open air type deals. And this, we have a totally empty, you know, this is a true residential center. So if you were looking for a way to detain families and keep them as an integral unit, a nuclear family, and you needed a space to detain them, this is what I think the government should do, not basically try to retrofit a prison and create a living environment for children. That is just not it. Taylor is it's a very small community, and growing up in Taylor is basically the same as anybody growing up in any small town. A lot of people in Taylor saw it as an economic boom for this community. Most small towns that you know, we're losing manufacturing jobs, we're looking for ways to create something that was stable. Prisons for profit are very profitable, but they're not profitable to the community that they are based in. They're profitable to the shareholders of that corporation.
Selvas, pampas y montañas, patria o muerte su destino. Selvas, pampas y montañas, patria o muerte su destino.
Support for Co-op comes from Kent Cummins Magic Camp, a day camp working to help children in Central Texas for 16 years by teaching them magic and public speaking skills. The camp helped nearly 800 children this summer and plans to serve more than 1,000 in 2009. For more information, you may visit www.magiccamp.org or call Kent at 512-288-1596. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. A moment ago, you heard an excerpt from a documentary. No, not about the Magic Camp, but about the Don Hutto residential facility for immigrant families who have been detained. That was the voice of Jose Orta, a resident of Taylor, Texas, which is where the facility is located, who is opposed to what the Corrections Corporation of America is doing. Bob, why don't we hear from you a little bit about the privatization of prisons?
Yeah, and I think that in many ways Hutto is a perfect example of the things that go wrong when you have a industry that is based on profiting from the expansion of the prison system and the immigrant detention system. The private prison industry was started in the mid-1980s, early 1980s, and the first private prison was actually one of the first immigrant detention centers. It was the Houston Processing Center, which is a Corrections Corporation of America owned immigrant detention center in Houston. And
what year did that start?
It opened in 1984, I believe. And so you can really trace the rise of the private prison industry along with the expansion of the immigrant detention industry, as well as these other sort of concurrent trends of privatization of public infrastructure and the increased use of incarceration to deal with all populations, whether it's immigrants, people with criminal sentences, youth. The immigrant detention industry, the private prison industry has really capitalized on all of those aspects. And as Matt was mentioning, Hutto has been used in many of these areas, right? It's been a pretrial federal facility. It's been a state prison. It's been a housing point for evacuees from Katrina's prisons, from prisons around New Orleans. So it served a whole, you know, variety of functions, and that's one of the things that private prison corporations do is they'll often go build a prison and then they'll shop it around to different clients. And you have a whole host of problems, and you have a system where you don't have to make the hard decisions about increasing the incarcerated population because you have all this excess bed space out there that the private prison corporations shop around. So I think that there's, you know, a lot of really problematic aspects of the private prison industry, and a lot of them are played out in the way that Hutto was reopened as a place that basically everyone could have told you looking at it is an inappropriate place for children, you know, by all accounts. And yet, because the private prison industry had that that bed space out there, the federal government ended up using
that instead of the closed down rest home.
Right. And you know, I think that another important point to make is that there's very little rationale for keeping any of these families in any sort of secure setting, right? In any sort of prison-like or even, you know, even a less prison-like detention situation when there are proven alternatives to detention that are shown to ensure that immigrants show up for their immigration hearings, yet are far less costly and far more humane, right? They're not prison-like. They're not even you know, even more of the residential detention setting. Most of these people, there's no good reason for the government to be keeping them in these kind of facilities at all.
Elaborate a little bit about the link you see between the privatization of prisons and the trend toward immigrant detention.
Well, I think that there are very clear ways that the private prison industry tries to ensure that they continue to receive immigration contracts. There's a really excellent website, The Business of Detention, that goes into a lot of these aspects and sort of traces specifically with Corrections Corporation of America and how their stock prices and their profit margins have increased dramatically with the increase of immigrant detention. And one of the ways that they ensure that they receive these contracts is through federal lobbying. Corrections Corporation of America spent several million dollars in 2007, last year we have numbers for, on federal lobbying. And they don't just lobby Congress people for contracts, they also go in and actually lobby the agencies. So they're in lobbying the Department of Homeland Security, lobbying the Department of Justice, even lobbying entities like the Bureau of Indian Affairs to try to win contracts for prisons. And so there's really a host of ways that they go about ensuring that they're that there's an ever-increasing incarcerated population so that they have ever-increasing markets.
Would it be fair to say that the dearth of blankets that are available at a facility like Cutto and the limited quantity of food available even to pregnant women has a lot to do with maximizing profit margins for CCA?
Sure, and I think it is important to note that many of the conditions, thanks to the advocacy and thanks to the lawsuit that was brought by the University of Texas Immigration Clinic and the ACLU, many of those things have improved dramatically. I mean, there's still many, many problems at Hutto, and there's a, you know, we certainly believe that there's no good reason to have these people in detention, that Hutto or any detention center is an inappropriate place for families. But many of those things have been better dramatically. But I do think that it is part of the mentality of the private prison corporation to skimp on everything, you know, things like blankets, things like food, and also things like medical care, things like, you know, things that are life or death situations a lot of times. You have a situation out in West Texas right now where there's a private prison that has immigrants awaiting deportation that are being held by the Federal Bureau of Prisons that has undergone two major disturbances, you know, riots that were protests of the real dire lack of medical care. That's the Reeves County Detention Center operated by the GEO Group. And, you know, the report, especially in the Mexican press, the reports have been absolutely horrendous of lack of medical care, several mysterious deaths that have occurred at the facility. So, you know, I think that it is emblematic of a larger lack of priority put on the basic needs of the people who are inside the facility. And also the people who work in the facility oftentimes are paid dramatically less than comparable people in public facilities. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that you have, you know, the situations that you do in a lot of private prisons and detention centers.
I noticed in the film, the documentary that Matt helped put together, Hutto, America's Family Prison, it says that it would actually be cheaper for these families to be staying at the Hilton Hotel than it would be for them to stay at Hutto.
Yeah, that's correct. They actually, the contract between Hutto is actually a flat rate contract, so they get paid a flat rate no matter how many detainees they have at the prison. And right now, with current, or at least the population when the film was completed, it averaged to about $200 a day per person. That's $200 a day per adult and per child that they spend every day. And, you know, alternatives to detention have been proven to cost anywhere from $20 to $12 per day. So it's by, you know, almost 10 times the amount that the government could be spending.
So it would actually be perhaps more cost efficient if the government just had its own public prisons like the way it used to.
Well, actually, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I guess I'm mainly referring to kind of alternative form to detention where immigrants and their families would, have their immigration hearing set and maybe under...
Oh, yeah, let me just be clear that the privatization of prisons is not necessarily... by talking about the privatization of prisons versus keeping them government-owned, mm-hmm. that's separate from what you do with the processing of immigrant families.
Right, right.
Which does not have to necessarily be detaining.
Exactly.
Which is the current policy right now, which gets us into the campaign that all three of you are involved in, which is the 100 Actions and 100 Days campaign to end immigrant family detention. What do you folks want to say about that?
The idea behind the 100 Actions to End Family Detention in the First 100 Days campaign, and there's a calendar that...
And that's the first 100 days of the Barack Obama administration.
Exactly, the first 100 days of the new administration. And there's a calendar that has many of these events at grassrootsleadership.org and also at the blog tdonhutto.blogspot.com. The idea behind this campaign is that many of the really harsh things that have happened with immigration policy, they're based in the law was created during the Clinton years, but the enforcement mechanisms that created many of these really harsh policies, including family detention, were administrative actions that the Bush administration took without a law that was passed by Congress. But they were administrative actions taken within the Department of Homeland Security. And so what we're saying is that if they could create these laws within the administration, that the new administration also has the ability to go back and say, you know what, this was a really bad idea to open a medium security prison like Hutto as a family detention center. And there are these alternative programs that are much more humane and less costly. We're going to go and we're going to, flip that switch and say we're going to utilize alternatives to detention programs for families, and we're going to end this practice of detaining immigrant children with their families in prison-like settings. And so the idea is to really raise up that issue in the first 100 days through a whole series of actions, whether it be the screening of the wonderful film that Matt and Lily made, people speaking like Luisana and Matt and Barbara and Denya and Nessa Rodriguez are speaking about detention on Monday, to vigils and protests outside of ICE offices. So there's a number of actions that people are planning all across the country in the first 100 days.
And a number of them are on your group's calendar. The website is grassrootsleadership.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea also isn't that these are all actions that, Luisana and Matt and I are doing, but that people are really taking the initiative and doing, things on their own. There's been some really wonderful creative work that's been done around Hutto and family detention. There's a campaign to involve artists and musicians in the campaign so that it's both a cultural movement as well as a political movement. And I think that one of the probably the only good thing about Hutto is that it has really engaged a really broad spectrum of the population, right? That it's really made a lot of people upset about this policy, and it's made them start thinking about what our government is doing about immigration and immigrant detention, so that it's really front and center in a lot of people's minds in a way that it never was before the opening of Hutto.
I want to get back to the 1996 immigration law. You care to describe it? Luisana, you care to describe it, Bob's pointing your way?
Right. Well, briefly, in 1996, Bill Clinton passed an immigration reform law that both created mandatory detention for immigrants, even long-time legal permanent residents of the country, to be detained without a right to a bail or bond, without a right to bond, while their immigration cases were being processed. And we all know, because of the huge bureaucracy that ICE is, immigration cases can take up to more than years, to be settled. So in addition to mandatory detention and deportation policies, and I say deportation because it expanded the list of deportable offenses that include misdemeanors for which a person can be exiled from the country, regardless of whether or not that person has rehabilitated his or herself, or regardless of whether the conviction was old and since then he or she has tried to do better for his or her family, and regardless of how many children, U.S. American citizen children, they have. One of the more dangerous and policies that we saw come out of the 96 reforms was also the provision of that is coded as 287G, and that's just a legal, I guess, code word for the increased collusion between local and state federal agencies and local and state agencies and authorities with federal agencies such as ICE, with
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I think for the first time, it allows local and state deputies or even employees of the government to enforce federal immigration law, which is something that is unprecedented, and that we have seen has caused a series of violent and racist persecutions in states like Arizona, where the sheriff officer there, I mean, I think Arizona is just like one case study of how extreme these type of policies and practices can go. You know, you have an entire community that is terrorized by Sheriff Arpaio's fear tactics, and he even has his own show on Fox. You know, he calls the press whenever he's about to so that he can announce his next raid, and he's deputized all of his sheriff officers to be trained and be able to enforce immigration law. So, you know, and it was an opportunity for them to do what they say is a crackdown. And the reality has been that, you have elementary schools being raided, you have taco stands being raided, you have laws being created that criminalize immigrants for what used to be considered civil violations of federal immigration law. And I think that I just want to reiterate what Bob said, even though these laws, it's important to remember that these laws were created during a Democratic administration. And even though Bush and Cheney's administration unilaterally without having to give an explanation to the American people or anybody, they've the way that they've managed to do their business has been so secret. I don't think that any organization or any there are people all over the country trying to figure out how to expose that secrecy that the Department of Homeland Security has created under its agency, ICE, newly created agency ICE. There's just so many things that have gone on that we still haven't really fully understood and seen the effects of. But we're hopeful, and we hope that Napolitano, and the Obama administration can see benefit to change, right? To a change of these policies and a reversal and rollback, an immediate end of them.
And Jan Napolitano is actually a former Board of State Governor from Arizona.
Right, which is this.
I find it interesting also about the passage of the immigration law happening in 1996. I guess things we need to keep in mind are it was a Democratic administration, albeit from a Democratic president who had previously been affiliated by the centrist right Democratic Leadership Council, mm-hmm. which is sometimes known as the Republican wing of the Democratic Party. Clinton would have had had been dealing with Republican majorities in both houses of Congress. But also, ironically enough, a lot of harsh law enforcement measures passed from that time came as the result, or rather the pretext, of what happened with the Oklahoma City bombing, mm-hmm. which, ironically enough, was done by white Americans.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. There's always, there's a long history of scapegoating and targeting immigrants for justifying policies that I guess people in power feel they have to shift toward, the argument is that we live in a post 9/11 world, and that.
And then in 96, they said we were living in a post Oklahoma world.
Right. And that these moments of a history that teach us that migration is the result of these larger global economic shifts, which the United States is and the residents of this country, the poor working residents of this country, are dealing with. I think all of us are listening closely to what the economic stimulus plan of Obama is going to be. Hopefully he provides a safety net for all of the displaced workers in states like Iowa. And so people are migrating across the world, and even Mexico. I just came back from a binational conversation with different organizations along the border, the border states with Mexico, and La Comisión Nacional de los Derechos Humanos, the Commission of Human Rights for in Mexico was there at the table, and they're trying to figure out ways that they can deal and demilitarize their borders with Guatemala and along with the U.S. As well, because they're seeing a series of an uprise of human rights violations against Central and South American refugees, and it's a disturbing and very painful reality for all of the families that have to find themselves en route to a foreign territory or community space. And so with that said, I really hope, and we really, one of our goals as organizers is to encourage people to see the reasons why a lot of these things are happening and why we should look for alternative ways of dealing with the situation rather than using old and very racist, might I say, criminal justice policy solutions to deal with it. I think we all remember, I was barely growing up during the war on drugs, but I know like when it was at its highest peak, right? It was in the sort of late 80s, but We see the effects of it now. I think all of us know of someone who's been locked up for simple possession of marijuana or different small misdemeanor offenses that result in long years of being trapped in the system of probation and incarceration. It's just one thing after another, and I don't want to go on and on, but there has to be an alternative to the detention of immigrants, and we need to stop.
I guess what you're talking about is policies that encourage the criminalization
right.
of immigrants. ostensibly anti-terrorist measures that terrorize the most vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. You just heard the voice of Luciana Santibanez, who's with the Grassroots Leadership, as is another guest of mine, Bob Leibel, also in the studio. And with us as well is Matthew Gossage, who's the co-filmmaker of the documentary Hutto, America's Telling Prison. We're going to go to a couple of messages, but we shall return. We're discussing immigrant family detention and the Grassroots Leadership's 100 Actions and 100 Days campaign to stop it. I'm Alan Campbell, and you're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
Listen into Waking Up Orwell February 12th to catch our recession-proof show, featuring Artivist Film Festival board members on what makes great dystopian filmmaking. Only on Waking Up Orwell, 2:30 to 3 p.m., Thursdays on KOOP 91.7 FM.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Nine. Is that a new car?
Yeah, it's a hybrid.
Nice. What'd you do with that old gas guzzler?
I donated it to Co-op's car donation program. It was easy. I just called 877-750-5667. That's 877-750-COOP, and they took care of the rest. I got a receipt to use on my income tax return, and Co-op, my favorite community radio station, got some cash in return. Everybody wins.
Wow. I wonder if they'll take my old leaky boat.
They'll take your old car, truck, or boat. Just call 877-750-COOP, and they'll do the rest.
What a great deal. I better go home and give them a call right now. Thanks, Nine. See you later.
See ya.
Welcome back. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. My guests this week are Matthew Gossage, filmmaker, who helped with Lily Kieber, her name is, Matt?
Yes, that's correct.
With Lily Kieber, he's the maker of the documentary Hutto, America's Family Prison. We're also here from two folks from Grassroots Leadership, Bob Leibel and Luciana Santibanez. Luciana, I last had you on my show in late April, the Friday before the March in a rally for immigrant rights. And, wow, institutional affiliations were quite a mouthful. You're on the advisory committee of the American Friends Service Committee. You're on the board of Podair. And you also have gotten funding, I believe, from George Soros on a project within Grassroots Leadership. Why don't you refresh listeners or let listeners know who didn't hear our show back in late April a little bit about that?
Yes, and thank you, Adin, for always having a space, a welcoming space for all of us to come and talk about these issues.
Oh, I'm happy to have you guys. Thank you for coming.
Right, and so the project I received 18-month funding for is to strengthen community-based building project that we called Familias Unidas por la Esperanza, which is Families United for Hope. And since then, we've developed strong relationships with former detainees and families of immigrant detainees that find themselves in not just immigrant detention centers, who find themselves being processed for deportation, but also in state and federal correctional facilities, and it's interesting because they're serving federal sentences for immigration violations, which is mostly reentry into the United States. A lot of people are deported. Many times unjustly so. Sometimes they're deported because their family didn't have enough money to hire a lawyer, or things happen so quickly. People are often manipulated and rushed through a process that is sometimes, many times, unfamiliar and dazzling to people who find themselves streamlined through it. But it's been a challenging project. Most immigrant detainees in Texas are coming from different states across the United States. They're being imported into Texas because it's argued that it's both cheaper and closer to the border to expedite their removal. And oftentimes we're talking to families who have returned and haven't been caught but are living clandestinely in the United States, even after long being deported, and who find that their engagement in issues such as this has to be low-key. So we're trying to so our project tries to find creative ways that we could approach these families and maintain their safety while validating their experiences and hopefully creating a system of knowledge that can teach people, immigrant communities and their families across the city and state what to expect in case you find yourself in that system, or how to survive it in case you don't know what's going on to you.
One of the interesting things coming out of the controversy with the Hutto Detention Center is the fact that families are told or threatened with being taken away from their kids if they're doing anything at odds with the prison authorities.
Yeah, that's something that we've heard, and certainly it seemed to have been common before the public protests and the lawsuit against the facility.
The threats
of separation as a disciplinary technique. I certainly hope that those things have subsided a little bit, but we've also had the case of a young girl who was separated from her mother for 4 days and left in the care of ICE agents and CCA employees while her mother was taken to a different detention center. And that was because they said that the mother wasn't complying with orders. So not just
Did
threats
they
of separation.
Specify what orders?
Well, I think it had something.
Did she take an extra blanket or something?
I think it was something related to a deportation order or that they didn't think that she was complying, and so they separated the families. But Hutto has explicitly said that we are not a place that child welfare agencies can go into because parents are always with their kids. That's been one of their major arguments. It's a family facility. It was open to maintain family unity, according to ICE. But we've had at least a few incidents where people have been separated from their kids. So it sort of, I think, undermines that
logic.
Just,
not necessarily just a threat, then.
No, yeah, it's been used at least two times that we know of. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about grassroots leadership. I understand it's only been the past 10 years that it's been focused on prison reform and addressing the problem of the punishment industry, as it were.
Yeah, grassroots leadership is a 28-year-old, might be 29-year-old now, social justice organization that was founded in Charlotte, North Carolina as a leadership development organization to develop new leadership amongst especially marginalized communities and to build a multiracial group of organizers to go out and build other organizations. So there are many organizations across the South that have ties to grassroots leadership's organizing work. And over time, grassroots leadership sort of saw the impact that privatization was having on communities, privatization of all sort of public resources. And increasingly, that privatization was taking the effect of both privatizing community resources that we view as good things, but also privatizing prisons and really building an even greater economic incentive towards expanding the incarcerated population. And this was particularly happening in the South. And so starting at the end of the 1990s, we took on a campaign around private prisons to limit the scope of private prisons, and ultimately the goal of the campaign is to abolish the use of for-profit incarceration. And so increasingly, unfortunately, what that's meant is that we fight the fight of around immigrant detention, because immigrant detention immigrants are the largest growing prison population, and immigrant detention is by far the leading profit maker for the private prison corporations, or at least the big growth area. And so in combating the private prison industry, we've increasingly seen the need to fight this growth of the private prison industry, or of the private immigrant detention industry, in that and you know, certainly the most egregious aspects of that, I think, are things like Hutto, things like the enormous immigrant detention centers in South Texas.
I understand that your executive director, Cy Khan, has a background in civil rights activism going back to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cy was one of the white members of SNCC in the 60s in several places throughout the South, and did, you know, a lot of civil rights organizing. And in addition to being a civil rights organizing and a labor, he went on to be a labor organizer with multiple unions throughout the South. And in addition to that life, Cy is also wears many hats, but he's also a folk singer of some recognition, and has done, I think, 13 albums or 14 albums of original music. Has played with Pete Seeger on some of his records, and so he's sort of a man of many talents. He's also a playwright. Has a musical opening in New York sometime soon, I think.
And I understand that he also has a song about Hutto.
He does indeed.
Why don't we go listen to that?
Great.
All right. Here is Cy Khan, the executive director of Grassroots Leadership, representing his organization here in the studio, is Bob Weibel and Luis Santibanez. And we also have in the studio as well Matthew Gossage, who's the co-creator of the documentary Hutto, America's Failing Prison. Here now is Cy Khan. I'm Alan Campbell, and you're listening to People United.
The man called T. Don Hutto must have been some kind of man, 'cause he sure got a man-sized share of fame. It's not just anybody gets their name put on a building where children are held prisoner in their name. The town of Taylor, Texas is not an hour from Austin, but when you're there, you're in a world away. Look inside the prison yard, just beyond the chain link fence, you will see young children at their play. You might well stop and ask yourself, what have these young children done to be sentenced to such painful loss and fear? It's all because their mom or dad was caught here without documents, like 40 million others living here. Now you may think all immigrants should go back where they came from, and if they don't, hell, let them rot in jail. But if it was your own daughter in a cell at T. Don Hutto, with her child in her arms, how would you feel? What would you say if your own 4 or 6 or 8 or 10 year old was growing up in prison like these kids? Since when in these United States do we put kids in prison because of what we say their parents did? Call it family detention, say we do it for the children. You're lying to yourself down at the roots. But call it playing politics with children's lives and sanity, you're getting somewhat closer to the truth. So if you're down in Austin, take the highway out to Taylor. Bring some good friends with you for the ride. You might even wear a flag pin to show you still believe in the dream for which so many fought and died. step out onto the highway, turn to face the prison, stare at those walls till you forget your name. Say a prayer for T. Dodd Hutto, say a prayer for all those children, then close your eyes and hang your head in shame.
But right now it's star time!
KOP wants to make you feel like a star.
Yeah!
And to do this, we are raffling off two chances to win a pair of all-access platinum badges to the 2009 South by Southwest International Music, Film, and Interactive Festival.
Funky! Get funky!
You'll be feeling mighty funky, all right, if on Valentine's Day, February 14th, we draw your name for a pair of South by Southwest platinum badges. Because you'll become very popular very quickly.
How you like it now?
KOP raffle tickets are only $10 for one or $25 for three, and getting them is as easy as...
1, 2, 3, 4!
All you gotta do is... to a computer. To KOP.org. Click on Buy Your Tickets here. And follow the instructions.
Yeah!
KOP South by Southwest raffle tickets.
Gets down to the nitty gritty.
And you're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. My guests in the studio this week are Bob Leibel and Luisana Santibanez of Grassroots Leadership, and Matthew Gossage, who with Lila Kieber is the maker of the documentary Hutto, America's Family Prison. Grassroots Leadership, with Matthew's participation, is taking part in a 100 Actions in 100 Days campaign, putting pressure on the Obama administration to change its enforcement of the 1996 immigration law and put an end to the detaining of immigrant families being processed. Now, Matthew and Luisana, you're taking part on a panel at TICE headquarters next Monday, February 9th. You guys want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's a panel discussion. It's part of the Austin Immigrant Rights Coalition's Just Immigration series, and it's every Monday in February at either TICE, Resistencia Bookstore, or Monkey Wrench Books. And kind of just to get the community discussing, you know, what would a just immigration policy be? You know, what kind of immigration policy can we create that will kind of reverse some of the injustices that have been done for so long? And every Monday it's a different topic, and this coming Monday it's on the issue of immigration detention. And myself and Luisana will be there, as well as Dania, who was in Hutto with her children, as well as Nestor Rodriguez and Eric Tang and Barbara Hines.
And Barbara Hines was in the documentary as well. You interviewed her.
Yes. She was very instrumental in the lawsuit in 2007, and she's done amazing work on this issue.
Anything you want to add, Luisana?
I think it's also, I guess, important to mention that Barbara Hines was also one of the main... she was also very involved in the making of another film called The Least of These, which is also about T-Don Hutto, America's Family Prison, and it is actually being screened at the South by Southwest show.
And there will be I don't think the dates are released, but it's premiering. This is a full-length film about Hutto, and it's premiering during South by Southwest, and the dates of the screenings at South by Southwest will be posted. We'll put them on the Grassroots Leadership 100 Actions and the First 100 Days calendar.
And I should mention, by the way, that Matt's video, if you haven't been able to make it out to public screening, is also available at Google Video, and it's available right now on the homepage of Grassroots Leadership, grassrootsleadership.org. Well, Bob Leibel and Luisana Santibanez of Grassroots Leadership and filmmaker Matthew Gossage, we're going to go to Rahul's commentary, but right now I want to thank you all so much for our studio discussion.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
We now go to
thank
our
you.
weekly commentary from Rahul Mahajan, who is going to be talking about the election results in Iraq. Here now is Rahul. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
Iraq's provincial elections held on Saturday have temporarily brought a spike in attention back to what is now the new forgotten war. Media reports have been terribly excited about the over 14,000 candidates running in the supposed great new Iraqi enthusiasm for democracy. Early results give a slightly more mixed picture. Although lots of candidates ran, many of them no doubt because they want access to the power of patronage, the main reason for congressmen in the United States as well, not that many people voted. It's not exactly fair to compare with the turnouts in 2005, which involved two national elections and a constitutional referendum, but turnout in the recent provincial elections is estimated at 51%, significantly lower even than U.S. turnout in the last two national elections, though much higher than for midterm elections. By contrast, the December 2005 national elections had a 76% turnout, and even the January elections, despite the boycott by many Sunnis, had 58%. That boycott affected national-level politics only for that year. By December, Sunnis had figured out what everyone in the history of electoral boycotts has learned at some point, that they never work. Unfortunately, since there were no new provincial elections, provincial governments have remained severely skewed in composition ever since. Overall, there were two striking results. First, Nouri al-Maliki has emerged as a politician with some national stature and at least a modicum of broad nationalist appeal. Much of this is probably related to his joint offensive with the United States against the Sadrists in Basra and elsewhere. Early criticisms of the surge for changing the military panorama in Iraq without affecting civilian national politics are once again revealed to be silly. Political effects simply took longer to manifest. The government and the armed forces definitely seem to have gained some legitimacy. Second, Ayad Alawi, the Shia former Ba'athist, is back on the scene. A clear sign of voter disaffection with the Shia Islamist parties. This disaffection is only partial. The aggregated votes for those parties is still pretty substantial. So far, reported irregularities seem minor. A few thousand Sunnis in places like Adhamiya may have been struck from the voter rolls by Shia election officers because they have telltale Sunni names like Omar. The scale is smaller than the shenanigans the Republicans pull every election cycle. The replacement of the Sunni boycott with the disaffected voter boycott is not necessarily such a bad thing either. Tuning out of the electoral process because you don't think it matters to you who gets elected is not only a time-honored tradition in countries more stable than Iraq, it's much better than whipping up turnout and fervor because you intend to use the electoral results as a weapon in sectarian conflict. Although the United States has almost certainly backed Alawi under the table, and is a major political player simply by virtue of its military operations, in general, Iraqis seem to ignore expressed U.S. preferences as much as possible, except when they involve direct military pressure. Iranian influence is also not what it once was, with sectarian effects waning and some putatively broad nationalism reasserting itself. The main point to take away is that insofar as these elections are a relatively muted success, they are a success of Iraqis, not of the Americans or of American intervention. While it is true that recent U.S. military operations have played some role in fixing some of the mess created by their earlier intervention, the pathological conditions it created, the story of the past year and more has consistently been one of Iraqis asserting themselves. In 2007, Parliament defeated a major U.S. push to pass an oil law. Last year, the status of forces negotiations amounted almost to a declaration of independence by the Iraqi government. Not only did they get what is officially an ironclad timetable for withdrawal, they won significant changes in how the United States does its military business. Given the low levels of violence and the increasing presence of the Iraqi military, it seems quite likely that the U.S. will be able to draw down troops and send them to screw things up in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We can already see our way to Bush's final likely legacy in Iraq. 500,000 to 1 million dead, destruction of the infrastructure of government and society, and creation of an authoritarian repressive state with actual political contestation through elections. I guess that's something to be proud of. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
The Empire Notes of Rahul Mahajan are our feature on People United. You've listened to People United, the show in solidarity with people of the world. This week, People United featured Bob Libel, Luisana Santibanez, and Matthew Gossage. on the campaign against immigrant family detention. Next week, we feature Robert King Wilkerson and Harkness and Scott Crowe on the Angola 3. Again, our regular commentary is by Rahul Mahajan. I'm Alan Campbell. Now, coming up next on KOP Hornsby Austin is Texas Politics Today with Deese Eckstein and David Kobarowski. You are listening to Co-op Radio.
This is KOOP Hornsby Austin, 91.7 FM on your FM dial and www.koop.org on streaming live over the internet.
I was walking down the street in the town where I was born. I was moving to the beat. I never felt before. I said, well, I opened up my eyes and I took a look around. I saw you written across the sky and the revolution starts now. Yeah, the revolution starts now. Now, and your eyes are burning fear. But here the walls are raining down. And the revolution starts here. And where you work and where you play. And where you lay your mother down. But what you do and what you say. The revolution starts now. Come to me.